Hello, Ralph T. Of Expansion Records experiencing its 40th anniversary this year.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, and I'm really thrilled to be talking to you about it because you and I have known each other a very long time and we actually go back to our blues and soul days. So, in light of the 40th anniversary, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to work at Blues and Soul as a journalist first? What inspired you to do that? And then we can continue on the story of how that led to Expansion Records.
Well, first of all, it's the love of music that gets me to do anything and everything that I do. Going right back to school when I started DJing, the age of sort of 15, and having, my parents say to me, well, you're not going to be DJing for a living. You've got to find something a little bit more substantial to do. I was always interested in working for a record label, but leaving school, I was like, well, how am I going to do that? So beyond pursuing the DJing bit a little bit, I started a magazine, a fanzine, music fanzine called Groove Weekly, which was all about soul and R&B. And actually, at the time, Blues and Soul didn't like me for that at all because
I wonder why.
a lot of the content came from America.
Okay.
It was American based, where there was this UK soul scene that wasn't really and truly being represented in the magazine at the time. So I had this weekly fanzine called Groove Weekly, and Bob Kilburn, who was the editor of Blues and Soul at the time, and the team there didn't like what I was doing.
Okay.
But after 2 years of doing that, I mean, I was really burning myself out, and it was just far too much work. It was getting bigger and more popular, but it was getting more adverts in, and then people weren't paying for the ads, and the print bills were
All
going
of
up, and
that, yeah.
doing that on my own,
Yes.
it was very, very, very stressful. So then I had to call it a day.
Okay.
By that time, Pete Tong,
Pete Tong,
yeah,
the
who's
famous Pete
is quite
Tong.
well known, isn't he?
He is.
He was now working at Blues and Soul, and he was there to sort of really address what they were missing, and then I was bringing to to soul fans in my fanzine, and he had a column there, not under his own name,
Oh, I
but
didn't.
he called it The Nose.
I remember that. I actually didn't know who it was.
Yeah, he didn't do it under his own name, but that was the fortnightly column that kept everyone up to date with all the latest gossip. But then he eventually was lured into the world of the record business and working for a record label. He got a job at Phonogram, at London Records. That's when he started his FFRR label. So he left Blues and Soul. And it was actually Pete Tong said to me, you should go and work for Blues and Soul. Because he was leaving. They need someone to really fill in for, what he was no longer able to do. And that time, when I went to that famous 153 Praed Street address, and I met Bob Kilburn, he welcomed me with open arms. Ralph, how you doing? Come on board, because he knew my magazine wasn't there anymore. So there I was at Blues and Soul, which is at the time you came to 153 Praed Street.
That's right. So I want to go backwards a little bit because before we get to that, how did you first discover, in a way, soul music and R&B? I mean, obviously, I assume you were listening to other music, or was that the only thing you ever heard? And how did you? Because I want one reason I'm asking that question is because, you could have liked other kinds of music and never decided you wanted to have to build any kind of career as a DJ or, well, even as a magazine, starting a fanzine. What was it about the music itself? You said it was about the music, but what was it about soul music, R&B, that had you be so drawn into it?
I'm just going to say it moved me, but before the soul music, before I discovered it, really, in the world, living in Northwest London, pretty much cut off from, where I was living and where I was going to school, from anything else that was going on in the music world. I mean, my original musical leanings were towards, I'd say, Elton John and the Carpenters
Very
and.
MOR, middle
Yeah,
of the road.
strings. I loved anything
Really?
with strings. Even classical, Mozart. I think if I was born sort of, in the late 1700s, I'd be a Mozart
Well,
fanatic.
maybe you've come back
You know,
from those times.
or in the days of Frank Sinatra,
Really?
I would have been an absolutely massive, massive
Really?
Frank Sinatra fan. But what got me into soul music originally was radio. I remember buying an FM tuner. you know, which had stereo radio, because I only had a little transistor radio before that, and then having this FM with all these stereophonic radios, radio stations on there. I mean, the first person who ever introduced me to soul music was Greg Edwards.
Really?
On a Capital Radio Soul Spectrum show.
Yes.
You know, 6 till 9 on a Saturday afternoon on Capital Capital Radio. And beyond that, I mean, I was then hearing about these, you know, wonderful records that weren't in the charts.
Yeah.
And I was going out and buying these records, going finding record shops in the West End, Groove Records and City Sounds
Contempo,
and Bluebird.
Maybe.
Actually, not so much Contempo at the time, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So I was buying all these imports, and I remember just talking about this among friends at school.
Mm.
And one guy who was at school with me hadn't really gelled with him up to that point, but heard me talking about these obscure sort of soul and jazz funk records, and he said to me, "Oh, you know, there's a guy on Radio London called Robbie Vincent."
Wow.
And he does a soul show as well.
Really?
So between those two radio shows and then my friend at school, that's how it all started. And then he and I started DJing together. And then it was actually the Saturday Night Fever movie soundtrack that took me away from all my studies. I was quite good, I'll say academic, but I'd done well with O-levels and I'd done well generally at school. But then when that movie came along, that soundtrack.
Really?
And all these wonderful records that were coming in from America around it. And my friend saying to me, you know, when we reached the sixth form at school, saying we should DJ for our sixth form discos. So that's how I started DJing at school. Okay. And again, that was the point Mum and Dad saying to me, look,
that's not a real career.
That's not a real career.
Yes, I mean, you know, that before,
but some other people have done pretty well at it, that's for sure. But in my case, it was like, another one really ought to do something a bit different.
Well, it's really interesting to hear you talk about that, because we do have some parallels there, although, of course, I'm a little more senior than you, age-wise. But it's interesting to say that, because a couple of things you said, like your love of strings. Well, I wasn't exactly M.O.R. What I heard was more like, you know, the Beatles. That's what the Beatles and the Liverpudlian, you could say, not invasion, because we've been invasion in America, but all the Liverpool artists, you know, Cilla Black, the Beatles, Billy J. Crane, all of those things. What I listened to in terms of pop. But the record that really was it, as I always tell people, is a record that had strings on it and was heavily orchestrated, but certainly was orchestrated, was Walk On By, by Dionne Warwick in America, Warwick in England. So I get that. And then it was, for me, it's a similar thing. Like, I got like, whoa, who is this? And same thing. It wasn't so much on the radio, but it was really on the television, because some of the artists would appear through a show called Ready, City, Go that Vicky Wickham was the producer of. And she loved R&B. And, of course, good friends with Dusty Springfield. And so, therefore, a lot of who loved R&B too. So a lot of the artists I actually got to see on television before I ever bought the records. But, I mean, it's interesting to see that parallel. And I want to ask you, the thing you said earlier about being moved. So what was the first record that you can remember hearing that moved you? And I assume you mean emotionally. I don't know if you meant moved into dancing. I don't know.
Well, the crossover from saying being a huge Karen Carpenter fan.
Yes.
You know, they long to be close to you.
Yes. Yes.
I think the switch was from that. It's a very gentle, subtle switch. Was actually to Diana Ross, Touch Me in the Morning.
Wow.
You know, which I found on a Diana Ross Greatest Hits Volume 2
really?
LP. And that was the kind of cross, you know.
Really?
And then the first soul album I bought, which is a result of listening to Greg Edwards on Soul Spectrum in 1975.
Wow. Yes.
Was City of Angels by The Miracles, which was the album where, you know, No More Smoking.
Yeah.
And it was Billy Griffin.
That's right. Wow. That's, because, you know, we've known each other for a long time, and I never asked you that, but I never knew what the genesis of your, like, getting into soul music as such was. And it's so funny when you said about Diana Ross, because the parallel for me is Dion. So interesting strings, ballad. I wasn't quite Karen Carpenter, because that was before. She came along later. But you know what I mean, like in terms of chronology. So it's interesting to see that connection. All right, now I'm going to ask you one more question about records. And yes, I got that was the kind of like a transition, in a sense, through Diana Ross and through the Miracles album. But we also know there's a different kind of soul record, which is very, like, deep emotion. Is there one like that that really was like, whoa? Can you think of anything like
that? I can't really think about anything like that, because, you know, going back to the strings, you know, I loved the Philly sound.
Really?
I love the lushness of it.
Yeah.
The deep soul of the 60s and the maybe the early 70s, you know, not so much. But, you know, I don't know if that's an age thing. I don't know, because, you know, I see how people are fanatical about, say, Northern soul and 60s mm-hmm. soul, you know, the golden era of soul, mm-hmm. the 60s. But I wasn't there.
I gotcha.
And, you know, when I sort of woke up yes. to this music, it was a time when, you know, the music was just so lush, so lavish, so,
yeah.
you know, luxurious, you know, hence luxury soul. It was luxurious. That's what I liked about it. The way the music felt, and the way, you know, the voice, more so than the lyrics, and is often the case, you know, moves me. The sound of the voice, you know, with those strings. That's what I really liked.
What it was. Well, I'm fascinated because I see some parallels. And what I want to ask you is, so you shared about having started the fanzine, mm-hmm. and then, you know, courtesy of certain influential people, you end up at Blues and Soul, and you are working there full time, I gathered. And so at what point in moving on, you said about wanting to work for a record label, right?
Yeah.
So how did that dream, in a sense, get realized after working at Blues and Soul?
Well, before I was working for any kind of magazine, the fanzine and Blues and Soul, I tried to pursue, you know, getting it, you know, making the tea, those kind of entry-level jobs within a record company, and couldn't do it. But now here I was at Blues and Soul, which actually wasn't strictly full-time.
Oh.
I mean, you know, I had a desk there, but because it was only fortnightly and I'd been used to doing my weekly fanzine, you know, I felt this not, I can do more things, right? So another thing I did, I became editor of Mixmag.
Really?
Which is the Tony Prince magazine that ran through his Disco Mix Club. Mm. Tony Prince was always very supportive of me. Mm. I mean, he was like, you know, the DJ on Radio Luxembourg. Mm. I was a guest of his on Radio Luxembourg. Mm. He was a fan of the magazine.
Yes.
And he brought me on board to be editor of Mixmag. So for a while, I had both Blues and Soul, which was fortnightly, and I had Mixmag that was monthly. I was running, and that was more than enough. And then Morgan Kahn.
Street famous records, Morgan Kahn.
Street Sounds Records.
Oh, yes.
Again, such a fan of what I'd done with Weekly. He said to me, look, I want to start a magazine. Why don't you come and, you know, come and work for me? And I'm like, well, I've got so many great things going already.
Yeah.
He said, but, you know, what I'm planning to do is going to be the biggest thing, you know, that you've ever seen in the magazine world. So I did.
Yes.
Go along with that.
Yes, I recall.
And so I became editor of Street Scene magazine in 1985 with this huge launch campaign. It was even launched on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, Tony Blackburn actually voiced the ads for it.
Wow.
And we did all these launch parties all around the country, but it didn't make it.
I know.
You know, it didn't make it. It was there for just shy of a year. Mm-hmm. You know, not going to go into all the reasons why it didn't fail. But this was a record company trying to be a magazine. And you know, there was some criticism around, well, the magazine only exists to write nice things about its own releases. Yeah. You know, there's some criticism around it. The format of it didn't quite work. But Morgan Kahn, you know, very kindly, actually, after the magazine wasn't there anymore, he said, well, come and do some record label projects. So I started doing compilations at that point. But the other good thing about that period was that all the other record labels, they now knew who I was. Because starting out, you know, a few years early, nobody knowing who I was. Suddenly they all knew who I was because they all wanted me to write about their artists.
Really? Well, of course, for the magazine.
So here I am, still with this ambition to you know, work for a record label. Oh, who do I fancy?
Oh, spoiled for choice.
Now, there was no more Philadelphia International. Right. I have to say it's my favourite label. Everything to do with Philly International, really? I just love what that label did. Gamble and Huff, Dexter Won't Sell. But they weren't physically there, you know, they were even their days at Sony as a you know, as a label deal they had over here, they weren't really active in 1985. It was pretty much all over.
That's true.
But Arista, now that's a different story, you know, because they still had some, you know, amazing acts still recording for them, and Blues and Soul had earlier compiled a number of EPs with Arista called Arista Funksters.
Oh, all right then.
So remembering that and thinking they still got so much amazing catalog that hasn't fully come out in the UK, I thought, well, I'll speak to them. I'll go to Arista. They're my next favourite label. You know, Clive Davis being a hero of mine, I will state that for the record.
Say that one more time.
Clive Davis being a hero of mine.
Oh, he was a hero of yours?
Yeah.
Okay.
I met him once while I was working at Arista. So I went to Arista and said, look, you know, any chance of, you know, doing something with you? And I was able to start off doing reissues with them. And that's how it started. So I was there, you know, working, you know, with Phyllis Hyman, reissuing her music, doing compilations on her. Don Blackman, you know, releasing his music in the first in the UK for the first time. Breakwater, Bobby Womack, Kashif. And then with their newer artists, I started to get involved with doing, on the club promotion side mainly, but I got involved with doing some remixes.
Really?
Like I did, you know, when Patrice Rushen signed Arista, the Watch Out album.
Yeah.
I got involved with some A&R side there. And they also let me do a little bit of A&R. I mean, it actually ended up being the only record I signed was Sharon D. Clarke.
Really?
Dance Your Way Out of the Door.
Wow. You know, I mean, there's so much you just said, and I want to just go back on a couple of things you said, but when you just said Sharon D. Clarke, I mean, who she's become, you know, in terms of who she is now as a well-known, established, I don't like to use actor about women, so as an actress, but who she is, I mean, really is phenomenal.
Fantastic.
Yeah, really. But before we get to that, I want to just share with you, because there's a couple of things you said there, and I want to ask you how when Morgan approached you about doing Street Scene, of course you had to sever your ties with Blues and Soul. And it's quite funny because that's something you and I have in common at that point, because I was still writing for Blues and Soul in America, and I guess I was pretty much probably the primary contributor to Blues and Soul from America. And I do recall, I'm not sure if it was you or might have been you, or was it Morgan, asked me, or maybe between two of you, I think I was visiting England at the time, and asked me if I would be willing to transfer.
I remember.
Yes. And I thought, well, yeah. Well, for different reasons, I said yes. And, you know, of course, when Blues and Soul found out, they were less than happy with me. And in particular, because I did a naughty, which I had a Stevie Wonder story, which was I'd done the interview with Stevie Wonder for Blues and Soul, but I hadn't sent it in for them. And I never forget, I think it must have been Morgan, who said to me, well, we're great to have this as, you know, on your first issue or second, whichever issue it was, you know, wow. I said, was a little bit, I said, he said, well, go on, you know. And of course, you know, I thought, well, part of a new magazine, and that's what I did. And for a little time, I don't know how this was for you, for Blues and Soul, but I was completely, in diplomatic circles, they call persona non grata. Like, you were not my name was, you know, synonymous with traitor. But how was it with you? I mean, was it hard for you to leave Blues and Soul?
It was hard, because they were so supportive of me and so nice to me generally.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, I mean, the courage up. We proofread the magazine once a fortnight at a studio in Waterloo. I don't know if you ever went there.
No.
Where the typesetters were and all that. Jeff Tarrick, was it?
Well, I knew Jeff Tarrick.
Yeah, so he was the guy who laid the magazine all out, you know, the days before, you know.
Never went.
The old-fashioned way of print and, you know, wasn't what we have now.
True.
And Bob and I used to go up there once a fortnight and proofread it. And I knew there was this particular Friday I was going to be there. And I was going to have to tell him that Friday. And this is after, you know, Morgan, you know, much like he must have done to you. And it was such a huge sales pitch on what this magazine was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, and Blues and Soul, they were on a budget, you know, as well. And you know, it wasn't a lot of money around. And when it came to I needed a new typewriter, I remember, they found me £40. Or I remember I had to go out It was tight, you know.
Yes, but, I know.
Whereas Morgan came along with all this, I'm going to splash out.
Oh, yes.
It's going to be amazing. Yeah, you know, it's going to be the UK Dance Music Report.
Yeah.
You know, that he was. Yeah. He wanted to match what was going on in America with all the new sounds that were coming in, that was not just strictly soul, but it was, you know, exploring all the other areas. So it's very hard to resist. So, yes, it was difficult, but... you know, they were very gracious. Even it was with such a hard thing to say, they were both still, look, we understand, you know, you've been, you know, we're sorry to see you go. There was no argument, no loss of temper. It was all fine. To the point where, you know, years later, well, I still write for them today.
That's true, you do.
I still write for them today.
You do, yes.
Because time elapsed, and, you know, street scene came and went, other things came and went. And they asked me, you know, there was kind of the magazine was in somebody else's hands for a while, wasn't it? It was kind of licensed out.
Absolutely, yes.
And they turned it square once, do you remember that? It went through a phase.
I remember it well.
Right, and then it came back in the house, and then they asked me, look, would you be interested?
Yeah.
In writing a column, so at which I said yes, and I've done it through to this day.
Well, I want to move back to what you talked about when you joined Arista, and in particular, I want to talk about the creative element of that when you said you started to do some remixes, and in a sense, we were doing A&R. What was that like for you?
Difficult,
really.
Just to be able to do what I felt I wanted to do and could do. And I was looking at all the other labels that were having dance music subsidiaries started, like A&M, they had Breakout.
That's right.
You know, and EMI had Syncopate,
and
Chrysalis had Cool Tempo.
Yeah.
And I even came up with a name for a dance label. I mean, it may sound crazy now, but I thought I'd call it First Records, First on the Dance Floor. You know. But, and the reason for that is because you've got A-R... IST.
Yeah, I get it.
IST, First, is a part of the spelling of Arista. Yeah. So it's First from Arista.
Yeah.
Went down like a lead balloon.
Oh dear.
Unfortunately. and the records they did have, they didn't have the most amazing US repertoire at that time.
Really?
To actually translate into something I felt I could really do something with in the UK without spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they were more interested in their UK signings and me getting involved with their US repertoire, you know, signing US tracks like a lot of the other majors were actually doing. But of course the one artist they did have at the time I was there was Whitney Houston.
Wow.
Now when she was at the time I started at Arista, they used freelance companies to do their promo.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they used to. They didn't have an in-house sort of club promotion.
You're talking about in the UK, right?
In the UK,
yeah, of course.
Yeah. They would bring in a freelance company and do it. And I remember when Clive Davis came to the UK offices in Cavendish Square, and he presented the second Whitney album.
Okay.
And the first single was going to be I Want to Dance with Somebody.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Met Clive there at the time. And I said not to Clive, but I said to the management, the A&R team at Arista, I said, well, who's going to be working this record, the club promotion? And because of I'd put Phyllis Hyman back in the charts. They'd spent all this money on these UK acts, but I did a little campaign on Phyllis.
Was it You Know How to Love Me?
It was You Know How to Love Me.
I remember
that. It wasn't a huge hit again, but it stirred up so much interest and sales. They were like, who is this guy? So then Whitney landed. And I said, who's going to do I Want to Answer Somebody? And they said, well, we don't know yet. Do you want to do it?
Wow.
So I said, yeah. So off the back of that, it was number one in the UK for 5 weeks. And from there, I ended up doing everything.
Really?
And again, from the US repertoire, they had, the other big breakthrough act at the time I was there was Kenny G with Songbird.
Oh, yeah.
And I did Songbird.
Wow.
And that was going to change Kenny G's life, that record.
Oh, I know. Absolutely. My recollection, of course, is that my connection to that is Preston Glass, who actually produced, I think, not the entire, maybe produced the whole album, I'm not sure, but he was very intimately involved with that album. So, it's interesting how things connect. But go ahead, so Kenny G. Yeah.
And they also had Aretha.
Well, hello.
Now,
yes, they did.
Now, like a lot of the acts who had been with Aristotle and were still with Aristotle, the time I was there was not their heyday, I'm going to say. And, for Aretha at Arista, my favourite albums are the two that Luther
really?
Produced. Mm. Post that, it was all starting to, still great. She's still sounding great, and there's still some great sort of pop records.
Well, yes.
That Nada Michael Walden was doing. But the one record that she had to give that was going to be a hit was the George Michael duet, I knew you were waiting. Yeah. But
the
deal was with George, it had to be on Epic. It was on Arista.
Yeah.
Epic, George's company wouldn't let George be on Arista for that release. So it was he recorded the duet that was on the album.
Yeah.
But it had to come out on
I did
Epic,
know that.
So I didn't get to do that.
Wow.
So in the meantime, I was doing more of my, going through the catalogue, working. And then Arista and RCA merged.
Oh, right, I remember that.
Under BMG.
Yes.
And at that time, RCA, I would say, became the more dominant partner between RCA and Arista.
Yeah, yeah.
And even with the reissue side... Mm-hmm. RCA had already established a series called Rare.
Oh, I didn't know.
Now, in
that
period, the Rare Groove period,
right,
had started. Whereas music had been changing, and a lot of the people growing up and loving the music I liked started to look back at some of the music that they'd missed, and hence the Rare Groove thing started. And RCA were ahead of that with their Rare series. But now Arista was part of BMG.
Yeah,
Rare could now access Arista tracks. Wow. And of course I didn't like that very much.
No.
And then ultimately what I was doing within Arista got swallowed up into RCA. So that was the end of me at Arista.
Ha. I've got to tell you something, of all the years I've known you, I didn't actually, this is the first conversation we've had where I actually got to see how you developed from one thing to another. I mean, we've never had a reason to talk about it, even though we've known each other professionally and personally for all these years. I've never thought about your journey. And I can see now, in the context of what we are next going to talk about, which is expansion, how that all, in a sense, led to that. So you had all of that background to bring to it. I'm not saying I thought you just came out of nowhere, but I'm just saying that's a lot of credentials to be able to bring to something. Really, it's not like, I was writing for blues and so on, blah, blah, blah. It's clearly, you established yourself and made a mark with the people that made a difference within the music industry. And then I'm assuming, I want to ask you one question about this because it's related to the beginning of expansion. In terms of public perception, I mean public in terms of the specific dance music, R&B, soul community, did they know you?
I mean, maybe through blues and soul.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Maybe through the street scene. Right. But you had this whole sort of UK sort of mafia soul scene going on. They called it the UK soul mafia. I was never really a part of that. Okay. I wasn't a big DJ. I was Print. And yes, you know, I DJ'd.
Yeah.
You know, but I wasn't, you know, Pete Tong, Chris Hill, Robbie right, Vincent, right. Greg, you know, Sean French or Chris Brown or one of those big Froggy, you know, Pete Tong. I wasn't part of that set. You know, I'd love to have been, but
Would you really?
I wasn't, you know.
Well, when you say you would love to have been, I guess you could say if you had been, then maybe expansion wouldn't have happened the way it did.
One of the people who was supportive of what I did was Richard Serling.
Yeah.
In the northwest of England, you know, in Manchester, because you know, I'd got to know Richard through Blues and Soul and also the street scene, because he wrote a column.
That's right.
In the streets, and even when I was at Arista, you know, he would come down to Arista, and I remember him loving one of the Whitney tracks. You know,
really?
Her doing, you know, For the Love of You. Do you remember that?
Just
the Lonely Brilliant. Talking.
Brilliant.
You know.
Brilliant.
We were chatting within Arista when I was there. So he knew where I was. Yeah. And also DJ-wise, I mean, he was probably the first person to give me a break and start inviting me to the northwest of England to DJ at his function.
Wow, really?
So, yeah.
Wow. So just to go backwards a moment, and then we can move forward, of course. So we've talked about the work of your record companies, writing for Blues and Soul. Can you remember the first performance you saw by anyone of note that really, at that particular point, was outstanding? A performance you went to see, something that. A show you saw that was like, wow. We know it's one thing to listen to music, hear it, love it, and then there's a whole other element called performance, which is not the same thing. And some people are great performers and not great recording artists. Some people are great recording artists, not great performers. And then there's some magical people who are both. So you remember who, if there was one show that really impacted you?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, the first shows I saw, the first soul show I saw was at the Palladium, London Palladium. It was Candy Staten with the Stylistics.
Wow.
With Russell Tompkins there doing, you know, You Make Me Feel Brand New. It was like, oh my God. I remember going and buying the Stylistics album. You know, I love that sort of loitering ending with just the strings. Yeah. Oh my God, it's fantastic.
Wow.
And then Hammersmith, Odeon as it was at the time.
Yes.
I mean, the first show I saw there. That was really fantastic. It was Crown Heights Affair. It was
really?
Just off the back of their Dreaming a Dream out.
Yeah.
You know, with Galaxy of Love and all that kind of thing. But the actual show, to answer your question,
yes,
was Roy Ayres.
Yeah.
In 1978.
Yeah.
His You Send Me Tour.
Wow.
So you had the combination of, you know, it's Carla Vaughan was
vocalist.
Was guest vocalist. Mm-hmm. So you had what she was doing vocally. You had what Roy was doing, both as a you know, an entertainer and playing those vibes, you know, and and those classic tracks that were big in the clubs at the time, like Absolutely. Running Away and, you know, Can You See Me and things like that. That show, you know, nothing was the same for me. I think after
really?
The show, I thought, my life is now in this music. That was
really
that was the
sounds one. Like a defining moment.
Yeah,
amazing! Wow. Well, good. So this is good. This sets us up to talk about a couple of things. Firstly, obviously, from Arista. And then you say you continue to DJ and then doing the stuff with Richard Serling. Not stuff, but, you know, he's having you do shows with him. So at what point did expansion emerge? And was there something in between, or was that just the next thing after the Arista RCA emerging? And is that the next thing that happened for you?
It was the next thing that happened to me. I mean, Richard Serling and John Anderson, who founded Expansion, they'd previously had a label called Grapevine.
Oh, okay.
And that ran through RCA.
I see.
When Richard was a promotions man for RCA in the northwest of England.
I didn't even know that.
Yes.
Wow, these people have such histories I don't know anything about. But I should say, for those who may not know, the reason I wouldn't have known that is because I was living in America and I would not have known about exactly what was happening in Britain other than when I was writing for Blues and Soul. So yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah. So Grapevine were doing a similar thing to what Expansion started to do,
like
seeking out these independent releases that, you know, people either didn't know about here or couldn't get. You know, significantly was Leo Sonship, Give Me the Sunshine, which became, you know, a big release on Expansion a bit later on.
Yeah.
So Richard and John started it out of what was a mail order business in King's Lynn called Soul Bowl that they had. Now that label originally had a UK base through PRT Distribution. They're an independent distributor at the time.
I kind of vaguely know of the name. I won't know much about it, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so they were one of the labels through PRT when they first started in 1986. So they'd begun that without me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew they were doing it, and I thought, well, this is amazing. I was still at Arista at the time.
Right.
And it was really only when the Arista thing,
when the RCA,
when that finished, and Richard said, or Richard and John said, like, we'd like you to come and come and join us and be our guy in London. And I remember thinking, well, fantastic, but I didn't want to just work for them. You know, I kind of wanted to be a part of it,
a share of the goodies.
I wanted to be a part of it. So I actually bought a third of the company.
Really?
So we then owned it. The three of us owned it, and then I got to work sort of running it totally independently from London, running it out of the back of my car, really, you know, because some of the big wholesalers were kind of in London, so I remember I'd go to the pressing plant, go to Daymont Audio in Hayes, you know, load up with a new 12-inch and drive into London, go around all the places that needed to buy it. So that was early doors of expansion.
So it was already called Expansion.
But it was already
John and Richard. Yeah. I got you. So how did they define your role? Or was it defined? You said the guy in London? Or, I mean, as I say, you were a partner at that point. So, I mean, did you have a particular... Did each person have a role within the company? Or was this everybody doing the same? Everyone doing everything, you know, kind of collectively?
I think my role was more the mechanics of it.
Okay.
To start with. So you had John Anderson, who would go to America, you know, and find all these wonderful releases, you know. And I think at the time, going back to 1986, I think music in the mainstream was starting to change. You know, it would become a lot more electronic, and even our heroes, still on big labels, you know, were in a position where their music was starting to sound a little bit clunky. It wasn't quite their heyday anymore, referencing earlier, I think, about that period.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the better releases were coming out on these small independent labels. Now, before, you know, the joined up world that we have today,
yes,
you know, the person going out there and finding these releases was John Anderson.
It was John, okay.
So John was out there, you know, finding,
scouting around. There you go, scouting around.
For records to sell in his mail order, but also for the label, thinking, well, that's a particularly big one. Yeah. You know, maybe we should put that out.
Oh, do a deal with them. Yeah, yeah.
And then there was Richard, you know, who would be on the radio,
right?
You know, playing them to people.
Yeah.
These, you know, massive audience that, you know, Richard's always had, still to this day. And also doing his events and playing them as a DJ and creating this demand. So the demand was there. Mm. John had found who owned these records.
Yeah, yeah.
But they needed someone to kind of like do the slightly more laborious, you know, back office type stuff, like, you know, do the paperwork, get the audio masters, do the artwork, deal with the pressing plants and distribution. So that was more my role at the start.
At that part.
Yeah.